the Southern Hemisphere. This is the Bondi Tunes Radio Network with Henry O'Donovan.
This is Bondi Tunes International, broadcasting around your world. I'm Henry on Bondi Beach in Sydney, Australia, and I'm joined by our North America correspondent, Thomas Booker, in San Antonio de Bayar in Texas.
Peace, partner.
You're supposed to say yee-haw. Okay, let's actually talk about the 1960s, which is a very radical time after the beautiful, beautifully comfortable 50s in North America, where everyone bought nice cars and had white picket fences in the suburbs of places like New York and Los Angeles, and had their little houses, and everyone was happy. And then what happened in the 60s? Where do we start with this? Thomas.
Well, okay, it's protracted. The 60s kind of started in the 50s, kind of started in the late 40s. And initially what was going on with what was that we now know as beatniks, but there was the beat generation, and they were like disenchanted. There were two groups of disenchanted veterans from World War II. And one of them, and they were associated with that era, and I don't know whatever role they played in it or didn't play. But one of the groups, you know, became these soul-searching artists and novelists and whatnot. You know, they're associated with jazz and bongo drums and the beatnik goatee and all that kind of thing. The other group that came out of it were these bitter, hard-bitten, angry men who had been in combat and had, you know, really proved their masculinity and what tough guys they were, and they didn't have any way of thinking about how to settle back into civilian life. And they were the Hells. They wound up organizing the Hells Angels, which is now a planetary-wide.
But Thomas, were these people like they'd come out of the Second World War? I'm guessing.
Yes, so they were affected one way or the other by it, or affected
PTSD, that kind of thing.
Yeah, similar. Much along that line, and otherwise, there were people who were also kind of hiding part of their personality because they had to. The beat poets, Allen Ginsberg, I think, had to hide his homosexuality. That's other things going on, the illegality. I mean, so there was, what my point being is that there were several threads of underground in the era preceding the 60s. Yeah. And then also, the other time too, there was unrest during the 50s because the civil rights movement was coming up on its way.
And the Korean War.
The Korean War was another one, and that was another trauma. That started in 1949. Actually, it wound up being 1950. Yes.
Wow.
Because, oh God, that's a long story. That's another story in itself about Korea, the peninsula of Korea, and how it got screwed over. It was handled over. No, that's another.
So Thomas Booker, while America was celebrating, I guess, the end of the Second World War from, you know, in the 50s, there was all this stuff going on in Korea. Do they just like ignore that conveniently and still build their white picket fences?
Well, what happened? Okay, this goes all the way back into, I think, 1895, when the Russian Navy was trying to wage war with Japan over Manchuria and disputed areas. And the Russians, this is an insane story, but the Japanese were actually highly militarized partly because in the early 1850s, 1845, something like that, the United States basically pushed its way into Japan and told them that they were going to become part of the rest of the world if they liked it or not.
Yes.
And they didn't realize what they planted, but eventually what happened was they modernized, and within the span of about 50 years, Japan went from being a feudalistic society to being a major industrial nation.
Powerhouse,
a powerhouse and highly sophisticated. Mm. But what they wound up doing was the Russians had this, they have the Trans-Siberian Railroad, which this we'll make this all come together in the 60s in a minute, but
sure.
But the Russians had the Trans-Siberian Railroad that was incomplete, and they couldn't communicate between Moscow and Vladivostok on the Pacific coast. It took forever. And they had an army there that was battling with Japan for possession of Manchuria. And what happened was the Russians thought they would take the Japanese Navy on, so they sent their fleet, but they had to send the fleet from the Baltic Sea through the Mediterranean Sea, through the Straits of Gibraltar, all the way down to Africa, and looping around and coming back up. And all this time they were doing that, Japanese spies were monitoring the fleet and communicating it by, you know, international telegraph back to Tokyo. So by the time the Russian fleet arrived, the Japanese fleet was ready for them, and they blew the whole fleet. They blew the fleet out of the water. I mean, it was just a crushing defeat.
Right.
So as a result of that, at the time, there was a peace treaty that was negotiated between the Russians and the Japanese. And the officiator of that treaty negotiation was Theodore Roosevelt, President Roosevelt. And Roosevelt became enamored. Roosevelt hated Russians. He thought that they were, you know, just like knuckle-dragging goons, which, you know, he may have had a point.
I think he might have.
He's very much enamored with the Japanese. And there was one particular Japanese military adjutant who he invited to stay at the White House for a couple of years, and, you know, treated him like a son, and just really gushed all over the Japanese and thought they were, because they were warriors, because they defeated the Russians and they were mighty warriors, and they were, you know, he just admired them for all those properties that later on came to be problematic for the United States. But what he wound up doing as part of the treaty negotiation was to give Korea, and now Korea itself, it was already formulating a nation state, and they wanted to become independent, but the treaty negotiations wound up giving Korea to Japan as a protectorate.
Right.
And that was what led to, I don't know if you remember all the stories, like from World War II, about the, excuse me, just one second. Had a frog in my throat. If you remember all the stories from World War II about the Japanese soldiers being awarded comfort girls from Korea. And I was always wondering how the hell that worked out. You know, it turns out that Japan kind of owned Korea, and they could do with it what they wanted to. And it was pretty, you know, pretty grotesque.
We must get into the 60s.
We will.
How did this affect, let's say, you know, as the turn of the decade, 1960s?
So what happened was, the other thing was that in terms of China, the relationships between China and the United States were really sour, because the United States had backed Chiang Kai-shek, who was, that's another long story. Anyway, China, Mao Zedong hated the United States because the United States abandoned him and favored this fascist would want to be dictator. And what happened when the things were settled and they were trying to work out how the world was going to be divided, China went ahead and started to invade Korea. And then that meant communists were taking over Korea, and so the United States had to. That was why we had the war that lasted up to 1953. It wound up becoming a stalemate, and why Korea was chopped in two. So the lower, eventually, the lower state, even though it was under an authoritarian dictator for a few years, Korea, to its credit, wound up overthrowing all of that after Chiang Kai-shek, but I got to remember. Their particular authoritarian government that had been established, the South Koreans overthrew it, and they became started to develop themselves into a thriving democracy and industrial and capital enterprise. And so that's basically where the things. But the result was the soldiers, the war in there, and the war that involved United States soldiers. After that war, they had been through, some of them had seen some horrific, had some really horrific experiences. It was a bloody mess. But there were, yes, people who came out of that era who were disenchanted as a result of that. And just, you know, it could just be basically, you know, traumatic stress. I mean, but they weren't really overjoyed necessarily that they had fought in Korea and had a victory over communism. As a matter of fact, they were having doubts about it. Anyway, another big factor was that Vietnam was cranked up, and they were, even during the Kennedy era, they were having difficulties trying to figure out whether they wanted to walk away from Vietnam or they were told if they didn't fight the commies in Vietnam, there would be the domino theory and all that. So they began this war in Vietnam, which, you know, even it became, as it continued on, as it wound on, it became even more and more demoralizing to certain sectors of the nation, because there was no result. There wasn't any kind of heroic invasion.
It just, and they lost that war, of course, didn't they? Is that questionable, or did they lose the war, or did it just stop the Vietnam War?
They didn't lose the war, they just didn't win it. And the problem was, by the time that things, you know, broke in the very early 70s, they just basically threw in the towel. And this was all, oddly enough, John F. Kennedy was being, de Gaulle, general, you know, the president, Charles de Gaulle of France, who's advising him to get out of Vietnam, because the France had just finished, and later on in their past in the 50s, got cream, and they just gave it up. And the United States took over and tried to prop up a puppet government in the South. But anyway, what was happening was there was stalemate, and there were people being drafted, young men being drafted, sent over there, and some of them came back intact, some of them got blown to pieces, and it started to become more and more of an outrage among the people who had to, you know, who were being called upon to go.
So you know what's interesting, sorry to interrupt you, what's interesting to me is, you know, after the Second World War, everyone had flags in the streets of New York, that kind of thing. But after Vietnam, there was no such thing as flags in the street and people waving. It was like going home with your tail between your legs. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I do believe it was a great shame when soldiers finally started coming back that they weren't given the recognition they deserved.
It's terrible, isn't it? It really is terrible.
No, it is, because where they were sent and what they had to go through, and then what they had to come back to was, and then, you know, they had the GI Bill and everything else, but there wasn't really this great wave of soldiers being given VA benefits to go to college and make some, you know, come out with some kind of education. There wasn't anything like that, like they did in World War II.
It was just mayhem. Now, I just want to let our listeners know that I'm talking with Thomas Booker, our North America correspondent in Texas. I'm Henry in Sydney, Australia, for Bondi Tunes International. Thomas, you sent me an interesting cartoon, because you're talking about rock and roll music, and I just want to quote this cartoon. There's two guys looking at each other. One says, "One of the greatest victories in the occult world was to penetrate the Christian music with their satanic beat." And the other guy says, "I know of Christian kids who destroyed their rock records, but after listening to Christian rock, the druid beat soon pulled them back to worldly rock music again. Then the desire to study of Bible cools off." Explain all this to me. I don't understand.
Well, what was happening, you know, okay, first of all, the Rolling Stones, and when the Rolling Stones first, I mean, a lot of what happened in the culture, probably a lot of what hit it was, of course, the rock and roll music, which wound up becoming, as the Rolling Stones were doing and others, you know, they started calling it acid rock. And I know that there was great disturbance in Great Britain. I watched this really bizarre news interview in the early 60s. It just was on the TV one day, like a Sunday afternoon special, when they were showing this. And the BBC had a special interview set up, and they were going to interview Mick Jagger. And they did it out in like someplace that was on a farm, and they flew Mick Jagger there in a helicopter, and then he got out and he sat at a table outside his house. And then they started, and then there was the British guy was a correspondent or anchor, started talking to him about the music and what it represented, and Mick Jagger was talking to him about, well, there's a, you know, there's the youth are, you know, there's a youth uprising, and that the young people are not seeing the world the same way as the establishment has, and went into this whole thing, and it was, you know, they were trying to confront the this rock and roll thing that was taking.
Yeah, sure.
But okay, so you had the Beatles, and you had the Rolling Stones, and then you had a protest songs. There were folk songs that were really popular at the end of the 50s.
And Peter, Paul, and Mary.
And yes, come on. I'm blank on him. The harmonica guy. Come on.
Dylan.
Dylan, yes, thank you. I was actually just
watching a documentary about Live Aid. Actually, I don't know if you've watched the documentary on Netflix. It was all about We Are the World, which was a song in 85. Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
And Bob but Dylan features in that.
That was much later.
But then, you
did have the protest music. You had Bob Dylan, and you had Joan Baez. And later on, a lot of the folk music sort of consolidated itself into anti-war and anti-establishment and peace and justice. And they were all in sympathy with the black civil rights movement.
Yeah.
And so this is the pot that was boiling, that boiled over into the 60s. And all of a sudden, there was this whole other, this counterculture. It was basically essentially a counterculture in the best sense of the word.
But it was a successful one, it has to be said.
To an extent.
Well, it took a while, right?
It took a while, and I don't know how much of it the influence is still being felt, or how much of it, yeah. I mean, there has been reform movements, and you know, toward the end of the '60s, we started seeing things. I mean, there was the environment was a big deal at last, and so there was a lot of mainstream interest in starting an environmental. Matter of fact, they actually
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, they convinced Richard Nixon. There was because of that one splinter movement. There was the anti-war movement. There was the peace and love movement. There was the turn-on, tune-in, drop-out movement.
Oh yeah, Timothy Leary. We love him.
Timothy Leary and all of that. And so there are all these other factions that were going on.
Mm.
And
can I just mention another faction that was going on? And I'm again quoting the History Channel. On the 27th of June, 1969, police raided the Stonewall Inn, a gay bar in New York City's Greenwich Village.
Yes.
The bar's patrons, sick of being subjected to harassment and discrimination, fought back. For 5 days, rioters took to the streets in protest. The word is out, one protester said. We have had it with oppression. Historians believe that this Stonewall rebellion marked the beginning of the gay rights movement. Thomas.
Yes, that was a breakthrough. Toward the end of the 60s, I mean, as we're talking about the 60s era,
yep.
That was where they finally got sick of it, because what was happening, okay, all the way back in the 60s and the 50s, there was a matter of fact, earlier than that, there was a major effort to purge, because this is part of the anti-communist movement and all of that bit. They started trying to dig out all the places where closeted homosexuals were working in the government,
mm-hmm.
and purged the government of them. And yes, the homosexual, the homosexual movement was very underground. It wasn't necessarily associated with all the others until.
Yeah, they literally had nightclubs underground, literally underground.
Yes, they did. They amazing. Did. And as a matter of fact, in some of the places, there would be New York City police in New York, who would go in and kind of pretend to be gay or anything like that. And if anybody kind of responded to them, they would bring the other guys in and they would arrest them and bust them. And then they wouldn't keep them in prison, but they would, you know, find their employers out and they would tell on them. I mean, you know, in some cases try to ruin their careers and just, you know, law enforcement people harassing a particular community of people was appalling.
Isn't it hard to believe, Thomas, that so much happened, like that kind of stuff happened only 50 plus years ago? I mean, it really isn't that long. Really, 1968, I think, was, I guess, the brutal North Vietnamese Tet Offensive convinced many people that, you know, the Vietnam War would be impossible to win. And I'm just going back to that for a second, because there was a lot going on in 68. 68 was Oh, the year my girlfriend was born, actually. It was a big year for America, wasn't it? And just pre-Woodstock in 1969.
Yes, well, 1968 was a horrible year because that was Martin Luther King was assassinated that year, and also it was Robert F. Kennedy.
Yeah, Bobby.
Bobby was trying to run. He was trying to run for president, and it was almost as certain that if he got in, he would end the war in Vietnam, and he would carry out revive the New Deal programs and eliminate poverty and oppression and basically the kind of reforms that people were opposing. And so he was hang on a second here.
Sure.
We're going to talk about the 60s. That was a beer.
Oh, beer! Oh, my goodness! Oh, yes, please. What time is it here? It's 25 to 3 in the afternoon.
I'm trying to see did it make it through WhatsApp?
It did make it through WhatsApp.
This is a breakthrough.
Is 25 to 3 in the afternoon okay to have a beer? It is Sunday, record. Thank you so much for that beer. It came over here in 3.2 seconds. again, I just want to get back to Woodstock because 400,000 people went to Woodstock, the music festival in upstate New York. I'm 10 years younger than you, and I'm 61, so I'm guessing you're 71, about 71.
I'm looking at it,
I had two excuses not to go to Woodstock. One was that I was only 9 years old, and the other was that I wasn't in the country. What's your excuse at the age of 19?
I didn't want to go. I really wasn't into the whole hippy-dippy thing of, the barefoot. Okay. Barefoot and hitchhiking and do all the other stuff. But, there was a convergence. I guess that was the height of the whole hippie movement, if you'd call it that. I mean, there really wasn't. The word hippie, as I understand it, there were early on with the Bohemians and stuff, this was in San Francisco, but there was the convergence of two streets, Haight and Ashbury. I don't know if you're familiar with Haight-Ashbury.
Yes.
And so they did have this kind of, beat kind of homeless people kind of hanging out. They were trying to do their, bits of poetry and music and all these other things. But there were what they called Haight-independent proprietors, which was it wound up being Haight Independent Proprietor. It was HIP, and that was mainly the kind of the shops that supplied them with tea and drugs and coffee shops and all this kind of stuff that was along the area. And I think from that the word hippie was derived.
Is that right? That's fascinating.
I don't know if it is. I just heard that was what it was the Haight Independent Proprietors and the people hanging out there, because the real action was, if you're going to San Francisco wearing flowers in your hair, that was one of the big gathering places.
And a great song, too.
Yeah. then there came the component of the expanded consciousness and trying to get into Middle Eastern and sort of distorting Middle Eastern religions by talking about LSD and psilocybin and consciousness expansion, and that was another faction. So there were all these different movements going on within it.
Thomas, do you think, we understand, we're talking about the 1960s and, gay rights. I think we've come a long way with gay rights. What do black people, in terms of the oppression of black people in the 50s and before, and then indeed in the 60s when they started fighting against this racism, do you think the black people of America feel that, obviously they don't feel we've gone far enough, or as in the American, establishment has gone far enough. What do they feel in America about all this?
The civil rights movement still continues on to this day. And as a matter of fact, when you consider the fact that we've taken a huge step backwards by having a Donald Trump as president, and then we also were seeing a rise in hate movements, literally,
yes.
Now We have a vigilante organizations, like we have in Texas, as it was against black people. They have a militia armies converging in Texas to try to push back the immigrant wave that's coming in across the. So there was prejudice and intolerance against people, Hispanic, Mexican Americans. As a matter of fact, I've found out a lot about San Antonio de Bear and the abuse and.
Of course, you are in Texas, and this is a big deal. Yeah.
But there was prejudice, there was dismissal and disdain for Mexican American people in the United States.
Still is there?
Still, to a degree, there still is. Yes, and you know they have their own rights movement carrying on. So all these were the other factors that were converging on it, it's hard to say what was going. All I can say is I was a kid in high school, and basically at that time, the high schools were in a panic because of the drugs, LSD, pot, and all the.
And Timothy Leary was responsible for it all. Yes, maybe not at all.
But they were trying. Oh, and Sonny, the one thing I could, if you can ever see it, I can just recommend it to your viewers, your audio audience. That
yes.
The Sonny Bono of Sonny and Cher made an anti-drug film in 16 millimeter, and he basically came out. He was wearing because it was the 60s, and he was trying to look hip and relevant. He came out wearing this Nehru jacket, and he introduced himself. This is a film about drugs. We're not going to preach about drugs. We're only going to present you with facts. Now, the thing is, you have to imagine this is 60 millimeter. In the back of the classroom, there were two guys in my high school, and these guys they were selling dope.
You're right.
And they also were a garage band, so they were drummers. Both of them were. And they used to sit back in the very back of the class, and they used to snigger and giggle at each other. And then every now and then they would glance across, and one would try to do a beat sequence on his desk, and the other one would go ba-dum, ba-bum, tsha, in the back of the class. But when this film was showing, and Sonny Bono was up there, and he was showing crap like some girl goes off and she takes a marijuana cigarette. She's driving in her convertible. Mm-hmm. And she goes into this ecstasy and drives her convertible off a cliff.
Are you kidding?
That. And these guys were sitting in the back just stupid.
So let me get this right. Sonny and Cher, they're promoting anti-drugs, which later became Just Say No. The president of the United States at the time, his wife, gosh, my brain's dead today.
Ronald Reagan, yeah, Nancy Reagan.
And Nancy Reagan and Just Say No, which was incredibly unsuccessful. And then, when Sonny and Cher promoting anti-drugs, surely they were taking drugs, Thomas.
Well, I don't think Cher had anything to do with it. I think it was strictly Sonny. I think by that time it was like later.
He was a piece of work, wasn't he?
I think, there was, it's ambiguous, but
yeah,
we had other anti-drug films, and they were equally as stupid. And
did they work? No.
No, they didn't, because they were condescending, and they also were inaccurate, and they were lying. And the kids in the class who were doing drugs were just,
having a laugh.
And that was one of the best times I ever had in high school, because high school was a terrible time for me. I was in a
really was it?
Oh God, yeah. And once again, I was aware of the fact that I was being, they were looking upon me, because maybe I needed to get myself ready and physically fit and all that, and then be able to go out and go to Vietnam or something.
If you're going to San Francisco, be sure to wear some flowers in your hair. If you're
worker on Bondi Tunes International.
Brilliant. I mean, for a high school art thing, he was an amazing painter and illustrator. But we got to be chums and stuff. And there was one day when he had a pass to get off campus, and so he invited me to go over to his house, and we smoked joints, and came back to school, and that was the best day I ever had in high
school. because you weren't a regular pot smoker, I'm guessing.
No, I was kind of, you know, confined. I didn't really have that much of a circle, and you know, I didn't get around that much to get in trouble with them. But man, that was a great day. I mean, I was in the high school, and then all of a sudden I was looking around. They had these lamps hanging from the ceilings in this room that were exactly like the lamps that were hanging from the ceiling in the school when I started kindergarten in New Orleans. I started flashing back to being a kid in New Orleans and looking at the lamps.
Wow.
All of a sudden, the whole thing was I was detached, and high school didn't bother me. It just wasn't right.
It just wasn't
relevant to my life.
Now listen, I just want to bring in Australia here, and hello to our listeners and Valley FM 89.5 in Canberra, our capital city, and also to our listeners on 88.2 World FM in Tawa, New Zealand. The reason I'm doing this is because in the 60s, when all this stuff was happening in America, it affected, of course, the whole world.
Oh, yes.
Including Australia. I mean, it saw the birth of civil rights movement in this country of Australia, greater moves towards equality for women in the workplace, and the beginnings of legal recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. The US president visited these shores for the first time, and an Australian prime minister disappeared. I don't know which one. Humankind walked on the moon, and Beatlemania swept the nation. And we're talking Australia, folks, not America. Yeah. It all happened in America, but that's how much it affected this country on the other side of the world.
Yes.
Amazing.
Yes.
And yeah, TV. It
did wind up being planetary in nature. I mean, I think there are a lot of other, countercultures popping up in different countries and in Europe. The Beatles wound up, you know, George Harrison wound up going to India and started studying under the guru, and there was all of a sudden Indian themes began to pop into the movements, and kids, the hell they were talking about were getting into meditation and opening consciousness, and then there were lots of people who were publishing books. There was a whole industry that wound up around the New Age thing, and that's where I began to start realizing something about it, that it wasn't really so much a movement per se as it was a marketing scheme.
You know, it's interesting. Just getting back to Australia for a second. Here in Australia, I wasn't here at the time. In fact, I wasn't born. Actually, I was, just about. We converted to decimal currency and created a TV show about a kangaroo that was seen around the world. Do you know the name of the TV show, Thomas? Because it was broadcast in America.
And it starred Skippy. A kangaroo?
Skippy.
Do you know Skippy? I think vaguely on the side. I don't think I ever saw any of the episodes.
Okay, you're probably too old for Skippy. Although adults, parents used to watch it with their kids. Skippy was very famous, and no matter where you're listening in the world, especially Britain, you will know Skippy because it put Australia. It took an animal to put us on the map, Thomas.
Well, whatever it takes. Skippy and Flipper and who else? Lassie.
Flipper, yeah. And Lassie, of course. Animals were running the world in the 1960s.
They were the ambassadors, yes.
Do you think, we've got to come to the end of this soon, do you think the 60s achieved what it wanted to? Because I always think the 70s were like a hangover from the 60s, and that's when I was becoming a teenager. As I look back on my life as a teenager, I feel that the 1970s, well, not necessarily my life, but generally what was going on in the 70s seemed to me like a hangover from the excitement of the 60s, because in the 70s there was a lot of bad stuff going on, but it wasn't it was like everyone just, it was like being at a party in the 60s and you wake up with a hangover in the 1970s. What were the 70s like for you?
Well, I think what happened was a lot of the people who were, you know, doing all the hippy-dippy trips and all of that started to grow up. And
have children.
A lot of them. Well, it wasn't just that, but they went. I think the one thing that happened toward the end of it was, first of all, most of the movements, the environmental movements, and all the other important and critical movements, sort of subsided, and they became kind of fringy.
They went out of fashion. They went out of fashion.
They went out of fashion, and so that was it revealed the level, how shallow the people interested in it were. But the other thing was that all the peace, love, happiness, and materialism, and all that stuff went out the window. And a lot of them, what happened was they went to college and they majored in business, and then they stayed in college for graduate school and got MBAs, and they came out and they started a economic libertarianism.
Looking for reforms, of course, yes.
They weren't looking for reforms, they were looking to get rich. It wound up being, what's in it for me?
This is what I find amazing. You know, it's well known that in college, and most people are left-wing, because that's cool. And then, and if we look back to the 60s, which is what we're talking about today, these were revolutionary kind of times, and people were out, against the Vietnam War, striding the streets. And then by the 1970s, they get college educated, they go out and get a job, and all of a sudden they go completely against everything they stood for before they left college. And I find that, really? Without shame, all of a sudden they've got children, they've got a mortgage in the suburbs of big cities like Los Angeles or New York. And it's like, forget all that stuff from the 60s. I've got to pay my mortgage now send my child to the most expensive school I can afford.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the affluence, they wanted to go for it. They wanted to get, filthy rich. And, the outcome of that is later on, the Reaganomics phenomena occurred in the 80s. And that was a catastrophe. So, basically and we're seeing the effects of it now, because my God, supposedly there was liberal progressive political action in the early days, and the Democratic Party was flush with it. But now we've just suffered having Trump.
Yes.
And they don't really know how to appeal to the public and try to bring back that interest of a society that's equal and supportive. Bottoms up economics. It's still in it. What's in it for me? And the prejudices have rearisen. There's racism. And like I'm saying, on the Texas border, there are a bunch of cowboys. Yes. They showed up in caravans. They were borrowing militia of soldiers from Florida. They've been offered to send them over there to go to.
But is it as bad as the 60s? Like, this is kind of almost like guerrilla warfare that's going on now, whereas the Vietnam War was an official thing that was fought against. How do you fight against this kind of stuff now?
Well, in the 60s, one of the things that happened in the 60s that was really interesting was the Black Panther movement. They decided to stand up really hardcore to the oppressors, and they began to invoke the Second Amendment, and they said they had their Second Amendment rights. So the Black Panthers wound up showing up in a lot of cases holding having rifles slung over their shoulders and pistol in their belt, and looking very, very intimidating. They were a pacifist movement. They were a social. Sorry, there's a train coming by.
Oh yeah, choo choo!
All aboard! Yeah, I told you it was a half a kilometer. But anyway, what we've got going on now is kind of a mirror image of that, where we're having all these old white guys who are all threatened by. The social relativism and
these are the guys who watch Fox News, right?
Yeah. And this one, and now we also confronted with, because that's one of the things I wanted to tell you with the aftermath of the 60s, that there was another phenomenon that came up, and that was the Jesus freaks.
Oh yeah.
And what they were was, they were trying, you know, they were kind of like a hippie movement, and they were kind of like, you know, hippie relevant and cool, but they were adopted the name Jesus freaks, and they were like a pest. As a matter of fact, there was a guy I was in high school with a few years later. I ran into him in the hallway and, you know, said, "Hey, how you doing?" And the first thing out of his mouth was, "Have you accepted Jesus Christ?" They were all over the.
Sorry to interrupt you, but our listeners know that I have cancer, and that I'm on chemotherapy, and I make it very public to our listeners on radio and on social media. And immediately from America, someone comes on social media and says, "Have you found God?" And I'm going, "Not really, but I'll keep looking. I'll look around. I'll check the spare room, you know, because it hasn't changed, particularly in America. Only in America, really, I think, where you've got these Jesus freaks. And no offense to people who are religious. That's not where I'm going with this. It's just that they're in your face, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes, still. And, you know, they have leaflets, and they're all wound up being all these subcults derived from that got to be really spooky. Because they tried to keep coming across like they're hippy dippy and cool, but they're actually, you know, trying to get you to convert to Jesus. But then
they want your money.
Yes. Well, of course they do that.
I'm quoting George Carlin there, the comedian.
yes. And
big money spinner.
Like the other thing that I hated was that they would take pop songs and they would convert them into.
Oh.
So instead of saying, you know, filling me softly, they would be filling me softly with His love, you know, I've given to Jesus, kind of thing. And so I was listening to it, and all of a sudden I said to myself, "God, is there nothing sacred with these people?" And then I started laughing to myself.
I watch a lot of movies. I'm a big movie buff, and I noticed that what's happening now is that the religious types are very, very subtle. They have these movies which are about religion, but they don't seem to be about religion. Mm-hmm. But as you watch this movie, suddenly God gets involved. And mm-hmm. I'm going, "Oh, no, not again." Because it's so subtle. And all of a sudden you realize you're watching a pro-religious film, you know? It's crazy. Yeah.
Well, I mean, and the result of it is that we now in the United States, a major leader, the person who's three steps away from the president, is a Christian nationalist and at one point he was actually talking about the fact that he knows what the origins of the Constitution are. The origins of the Constitution are a strong belief in God. And
Are you talking about DeSantis?
No, not DeSantis. This guy's Mike Johnson, and
I've never heard of
the
him.
House.
He's a speaker. Okay, and he's pro-Republican. He's a Republican speaker, obviously.
Oh yes, he's hardcore.
Very Republican.
So this whole plague of Jesus movements have really come to fruit. So now they've actually grown to be a threat.
How powerful is a guy like him in terms of Middle America? And let's not forget, you know, New York and Los Angeles are progressive states, and they're both Democrat states, if I think I'm correct in saying that. But Middle America is huge, and you got places like Iowa, who recently had a state election, and of course was won by the right Republican Party. Are there enough Americans? This might be a rhetorical question. Are there enough Americans who believe in this extremist kind of promotional stuff
in politics? I don't think so. I think the majority of Americans are just basically clueless. They're kind of zombie-ish. They don't feel the responsibility of being citizens. This is like talking about the 60s now. The abandonment of all the other things that some factions used to believe in.
Yeah.
And the active faction now are the right-wing Christian nationalists. And if Kamala Harris and Joe Biden happen to get on a plane and the plane happens to crash and they're both killed, this guy Mike Johnson could become president of the
United States. Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's, you know, just like Donald Trump could be, you know, as well.
Yep.
Although I don't think it's going to happen. And we're veering off the subject and we've got to go. Look, yep. I just want to ask you one more question. When you know, you're 71, is that right?
Well, looking at it.
So. Oh, you're 70. Okay, now, when you look back at your teenage years, I know you didn't like school very much from what you're saying on our broadcast, but do you look fondly back on those days? A lot of people do, regardless of what went on, but what was it like for you? Like, when you compare yourself to now, or even in the 80s and 90s, early zeros, do you look back nostalgically to the 60s and 70s?
No. I hated the 60s and I hated the early 70s.
Really?
And I was a pretty really seriously screwed up kid. One of the things that I did was to, because of other personal inadequacies and everything, but one of the things I did was I embraced mysticism and...
But not religion, right?
Not religion, no. It was conscious raising and...
I would say, you know, I'm a spiritualist. I believe in spiritualism and reincarnation. So I'm thinking that you went sort of not so far down that road.
It was like, Rosicrucian Society and out of the body and, you know, contacting the cosmic consciousness. And
yeah, it's kind of similar.
All the stuff that I did. But I finally snapped out of it sometime later. But there was a lot of other weird shit. I'm not going to use the scatological expression, but there was weird shit that I was dealing with. And
so you don't miss that time at all?
No. It was dreadful. And then, I was lost in this fantasy existentialism. And it was a waste of, you know, basically a waste of a few years. And I could have been doing something more meaningful and productive and progressive. So.
Do you think it's still a wonderful world, Thomas Booker? Or is it a better world? Let's put it that way. It's a freer world, surely. Or are we just kidding ourselves?
I'm just basically right now we're getting ready. You know, we're having instabilities in the Middle East.
And indeed,
authoritarians in Europe. And we're confronting a possible fascist takeover of the United States of America.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not that much of a ray of hope right now or at this time. I'm just
That's fair enough.
So I'm living right now in a state of anxiety, which as long as I can afford beer, I guess I can get through it.
Well, you know, you could always have a toke, have a bong, or something.
Yeah,
and that'll improve.
I can get chewables now. That would help too.
Indeed, and hemp and all that sort of stuff. Thomas Booker in Texas, thank you so much for joining. It's always so much fun talking to you. Thank you for joining us here on Bondi Tunes International.
Hey, man. Peace.
Peace, love, and understanding. This is Bondi Tunes International. This is Real Radio.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must a white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? How many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in. Before it's washed to the sea, how many years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free? How many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see? The answer, my friend, is is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. How many times must a man look up before he really sees the sky? How many ears must one person have before he can hear people cry? How many deaths will it take till he knows that too many people have died? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
Bon Calico. Entertaining Britain in the 70s. The 1970s marked the first full decade of color television in Britain, having been introduced in the late 60s. Color broadcasting in Europe was not standardized on the PAL format until the 1960s, and broadcast did not start until 1967. By this point, many of the technical problems in the early sets had been worked out, and the spread of color sets in Europe was rapid. By the mid-1970s, the only stations broadcasting in black and white were a few high-numbered UHF stations in small markets and a handful of low-power repeater stations in even smaller markets, such as vacation spots. By 1979, even the last of these had converted to color. It's possible that the greatest beneficiaries of the onset of color were outside sports events, such as football and horse racing. There's no doubt that one game was revolutionized, snooker. Up until the late 60s, it was a minority professional game, and it was played, except for a small number of professionals, mainly as a pastime. A major advance occurred in 1969 when the BBC's David Attenborough commissioned the snooker tournament Pot Black to demonstrate the potential of color television, with the green table and multicolored balls being ideal for showing off the advantage of color broadcasting. Veteran commentator Ted Lowe accidentally highlighted this when he once famously remarked during the Pot Black series, "For those of you watching in black and white, the pink ball is next to the green ball." The TV series became a rating success and was for a time the second most popular show on BBC Two. Interest in the game increased, and the 1978 World Championship was the first to be fully televised. The game quickly became a mainstream sport in the UK, Ireland, and much of the Commonwealth, and has enjoyed success in these areas ever since. It could never have experienced its tremendous growth nor attracted so many new young converts over the years without color TV coverage. That year of 1978 was notable for two things amongst many. It was the year that Steve Davis, the first snooker millionaire, turned professional. And in music, Saturday Night Fever became a cultural phenomenon, with the soundtrack hitting number one on the U.S. Billboard charts, where it would stay until July. The Bee Gees similarly dominated the singles charts during the first half of the year. At one point, the album was selling 1 million copies per week. Here are the Bee Gees with the song that remained as a number one single in the Billboard chart for 2 months, Night Fever.
Yeah.
And thank you so much for joining us here on Bondi Tunes International. My name's Henry, and I live on Bondi Beach. Oh, and just a word about our website, bonditunes.com, BONDITunes.com, where you can hear all our shows on demand. We've got three of them. We've got the Plus Show, which plays music from the 40s to the 90s, which is a lot of fun. And we've got the Love Show, which is Love is on the Air, is the name of it. And we play, well, what else but love songs? And then we have this hour, 2 hour chat show. They're all available on our podcast service for you if you go to bonditunes.com. Thanks. Bye bye.
The sun never sets on Bondi Tunes.